Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Ladaris Cordell. It is my pleasure to introduce Amy and David Goodman, authors of Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America. Amy Goodman is an investigative journalist and creator, host, and executive producer of the award-winning news program Democracy Now!, which airs on more than 225 stations across North America. Amy is the author of several best-selling books and co-writes a weekly column with Dennis Moynihan. She has received numerous awards for her investigative work, including the 2007 James Aronson Award for Social Justice Reporting, George Polk Award, and the Robert F. Kennedy Prize for International Reporting, and the Gandhi Peace Award. In 2014, Harvard University honored Amy with the I.F. Stone Medal for Journalistic Independence Lifetime Achievement Award. David Goodman is an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and host of the weekly public affairs radio show, The Vermont Conversation. He is a longtime contributing editor to Mother Jones Magazine, and his work has appeared in several national publications. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Amy and David Goodman. Welcome, Amy and David. Thank you so much for being here. I'm just thrilled to be able to have some time to talk to you. Democracy Now! Got its start in 1996, covering the presidential election involving Bill Clinton, Bob Dole, Ross Perot. 20 years later, Democracy Now! Is still here and going stronger than ever. So before we talk about your latest book, 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America, who are the Goodman siblings? Tell us about the Goodman household, and please don't leave out the part about David's press.
Okay, you want to break the story about Dave's press?
Okay. Although David is my younger brother, he was an inspiration to me to be a journalist. He was about 7 years old when he decided to publish Dave's Press. It was a monthly paper, and the subscription base was the extended Goodman family. Grandparents, great aunts and uncles, cousins. I think it was something like a penny a year, I should know, because I think I was treasurer.
It was quite a bit more than that. In fact, we got many complaints from our relatives. I remember one complaint was that I was charging more than Newsweek. It was, I think, $3.25 a year, which elicited howls of protest from the older generation. And you were the treasurer, so I think you fell down on the job in collecting.
And our older brother Steve Goodman, who is an epidemiologist and dean at the Stanford Medical School, I believe he was the envelope stuffer. Now, Dave's Press operated upstairs in our house in Dave's room. There were signs all over the house leading to Dave's Press so that in any room you were in, you always saw the arrow with the words Dave's Press. So you could not get lost in our house if you were looking for the publisher and editor of Dave's Press. He would be laboring in his room on an old, I don't know if it was a Xerox machine, but some of you may remember the kind of machine copier that he would put all of his weight down and it would burn the image from one piece of paper into another. Sometimes when he got exhausted, when the subscribership, when the base got very large, our father, who is an ophthalmologist and a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, would get down on his hands and knees with David, and he would press down as well. But David was solely responsible for the editorial contents of Dave's Press. Our father was just, I guess you could say, the muscle. So now, it was really interesting paper, actually. I mean, one part of it was sort of like a glorified family calendar. It would say things like, Mom spanked Amy on this day. My mother put her foot down and she said, you will not air the dirty laundry of our family in the pages of your newspaper. And then David cried censorship. And because he was 7 years old, he really cried. And But
this is the power of the press, to just let the tears flow.
In the letters to the editor page, that's where you found real substance. I mean, there were some very good articles, too. But that's where the greater...
Now she tells me.
Good person family weighed in on the issues of the day. And our grandfather would write in and say things like, "Dear Dividel, I'm so proud of you as publisher and editor of this newspaper." And then he would discuss, for example, the Vietnam War. And David would write back, "Dear Grandpa, I want to thank you for being the first subscriber of Dave's Press. Because you've done this, I love you." And then it would say, "But your," he, David would write, "but your views on war are stupid." You can guess who is for war and who is against war. But it was really the place where the letters to the editor page, where people hashed out the issues of the day. And Dave published this paper for quite some time, the monthly paper. Then it got a little bit difficult because he started to get active in other things. And so then the monthly became a bi-monthly, and this caused him great ethical angst because, you know, he had charged people this exorbitant amount of money, like $3 a year, and he didn't know what to do. And so he would make a double issue, and then it would be coming out every 3 months, every 4 months, a triple issue, which was harder than just doing the issues monthly. And then, David, as you pointed out, there were the deadbeats.
Yes, and we had a very effective way of keeping solvent. We would list the names of the deadbeat relatives who'd not paid on the front page. So that was headline news. And I do encourage, for all of you who work for nonprofits and things, public shaming is really a very effective way of staying in business.
Terrific.
So,
do you still have any copies of Dave's Press?
This is all true, and I have them.
Do you
yes,
still have them?
And yes, I was, you know, mixed in with the family minutiae was coverage of the Vietnam War, of New York City going broke in the early 70s. It really was all there.
That's your next book.
Was my first book.
And our brother Steve was also an important inspiration. We were all active in our junior high school and high school newspaper. We all became the editors of our paper. And, you know, it was amazing in high school that you could write an editorial, get it approved by the editorial board of the Maroon Echo, that was our paper, which we took extremely seriously. And we would publish this editorial attacking the principal. And he would actually change policy. I mean, just writing an editorial. And we realized truly the power of the press. And then going from high school on, you just move from the principal to the president. And you just work on a larger stage. But seriously, in when I was in about fifth grade, my dad, who was an ophthalmologist and sat on the library board for 25 years, the library was at the end of our block, and it really was our living room. Books were very important. It was the wallpaper of our house. I mean, books lined all the walls. And my dad was asked to be the head of a task force in Bayshore, Long Island, that would decide whether to integrate the schools. We had a diverse community, but it was de facto segregated by a kind of railroad tracks. So the question was, how would we grow up? And, you know, would the schools be neighborhood schools, or would they be first and second graders in one school, third and fourth graders in another? So it would be diverse. And I would go with my dad at night into the cafeterias and auditoriums of our community, thousands screaming parents. He would get death threats. It was extremely serious. But we watched as he judiciously really paved a way in our community to make our community more just. And that was always an example for us. And he would be sitting in his study talking with people quietly on the phone. My brother Steve, who was in the high school paper at the time, would have his ear glued to the door. And when my father would open the door, Steve would say, "I have a scoop. I have a scoop." And my father would say, "What are you talking about? That was completely off the record. I didn't even know you were listening." And he said, "You didn't say it was off the record at the beginning of your conversation." And my father would say, I did not know that you were eavesdropping. And then my father would chase Steve. He would be screaming once again, freedom of the press. And we, I mean, I think our family embodied all of these issues of what it means to have a free press in society.
So not too many people brag about their rap sheets. In fact, most people hide the fact that they've been arrested, but not you, Amy. In your introduction to the book, you proudly list your many arrests with this terrific lead-in, quote, as reporters, we shouldn't have to get a record for putting things on the record. I've never been arrested. I've never been handcuffed. I've never been to jail, and maybe that's a testament to my cowardice. I don't know. But what is it like? Do you get used to it? And David, what is it like for you when your sister gets arrested?
Well, I'll give one example, and this wasn't just me at all. It was the Republican convention of 2008. This was the Republican convention in St. Paul that followed the Democratic convention in Denver, where Barack Obama was nominated. There were mass protests there as well against the war in Iraq. A few days later, we flew to St. Paul, and this was the convention that would nominate John McCain and Sarah Palin. The first day, right before the first day of the convention, was Labor Day, and it was a beautiful blue sky day, and 10,000 people marched for peace, led by soldiers, some in full military regalia, and that's very brave to do that, who've gone to war, had come back, and said, no, this is not the answer. And they marched through the streets. We covered this, meaning we talked to people, put our microphones out, asked them questions. Then my colleagues went back to the TV studio to digitize tape, and I went to the floor of the convention center. That means, you know, you have all sorts of security. You've got the highest level of credentials. You can interview presidents, vice presidents, delegates. And I went there with Rick Rowley, who works for Big Noise Films, who would later go on to make the Oscar-nominated film Dirty Wars with former Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill. And we were on the floor of the convention interviewing delegates from the hottest state, from Alaska. And I got a call from our senior producer, Mike Burke. He said, come quickly to 7th and Jackson. Nicole and Sharif have been arrested and they've been bloodied by the police. I said, what are you talking about? They're working in the TV studio. No, he said, they're not, but I can't talk now. Get back out here. We had just made our way to the inner sanctum, the floor of the convention. But if our reporters were in danger, of course we had to go. So we raced out of the convention center, down the street, looking for 7th and Jackson. We saw it. It was surrounded by riot police. They had arrested many people inside. And I went to find the person in charge to get our reporters, Sharif Abdelkaddous, our senior producer, remarkable reporter, and Nicole Salazar, our multimedia reporter, to ensure that they did not get arrested, that we were able to get them out. I couldn't see anyone with the what we call scrambled eggs, you know, the gold braid, the higher level police officer. I was running down the line of riot police. And so I just stopped at one and I said, I said my name. I said, I'm with Democracy Now! And we need to have our reporters released. I need to speak to a supervising officer. And the police officer, the riot police, grabbed me, pulled my arms back, threw me through the line across the line of police, handcuffed me behind with my hands behind my back, threw me against a car and onto the ground, charging me with a misdemeanor, interfering with a peace officer. If only there was a peace officer in the vicinity. So from my vantage point splayed out on the ground, I am still desperately looking for Sharif and Nicole. I can't find Nicole anywhere, but Sharif was across the parking lot, standing with his arms behind his back. I demanded to be brought to him, and finally a police officer did, and we were both standing, handcuffed, our credentials on, and we were demanding to be released. We said, you know, we're journalists to anyone who would listen. We demand to be released. Whereupon the Secret Service came over and ripped the credentials from around our necks. Now, the reason we knew it was the Secret Service, you have to understand there's every level of security and law enforcement at what they call these national special security events. Often they cover their IDs, and it's hard to figure out who is who. But when they ripped our credentials from our necks, I turned to the police officer who had just tightened my handcuffs after I asked him to at least loosen them. And I said, you have no right to do this, to take our credentials. And he said, that wasn't us. That was the Secret Service. This would be very important later in the lawsuit that we would bring. But they took me into the police wagon. There was Nicole. Sharif, who was standing next to me, had been bloodied. His arm was bleeding. Nicole had her credentials on. Her face was bleeding, and she was handcuffed. I said, Nicole, what happened? I thought I left you leaving digitizing tape at the TV station. And she said, we saw the riot police outside. We saw them facing off with protesters. They wouldn't have been doing their jobs if they hadn't gotten the camera and microphone and raced downstairs. And they went outside. They were in this parking lot. Nicole was up against the cars filming. She did not plan to film her own violent arrest, but that's what happened. The riot police came at her. They were shouting, move, move. She was saying, where? She was pinned against the cars, and they said, on your face. On your face. She did not know what hit her. They took her down from behind and in front of her. They pushed her down on her face. The camera tumbled down. The battery they pulled out of the camera. If you were wondering what they wanted to stop from happening. Sharif is a very cool guy. And he told the riot police to calm down. Whereupon they took him, they threw him up against the wall, kicked him twice in the chest, bloodying his arm, and took him down. Sharif and Nicole faced felony riot charges. I was put in the police garage where they erected cages to hold the protesters, and Sharif and Nicole were taken to jail. There was such an outcry over our arrests. Thousands of people called, wrote, faxed, emailed, tweeted, however they communicated in this day in 2008, until after a number of hours, I was released and then Sharif and Nicole were. I was brought back to the convention center. Now the convention was over for the night. I was in the NBC skybox. I was being interviewed. And when they finished the interview, an NBC reporter came over to me and said, hey, why didn't I get arrested? And I said, I don't know. Were you outside covering the protests? He said, no. I said, well, that's the thing. I don't get arrested in the skybox either. You know, we have a job to perform. It's to interview delegates on the floor. It's to get into the corporate suites and see who's sponsoring the Democratic Governors Association, the Republican counterpart. And it's to go out into the streets. These are where the uninvited guests are, and there are thousands of them. Democracy is a messy thing, and it's our job to capture it all, and we shouldn't have to get a record when we put things on the record. So when we left the convention, I mean, they had arrested by the end of the convention more than 40 journalists, and we felt this was just wrong. Of course, we had so much to cover at this point. It's extremely hard to bring a lawsuit, but we felt this simply had to stop. So we brought the lawsuit. It went on for a number of years, and right before the 2012 convention, we decided to settle. We won a six-figure lawsuit. We flew to St. Paul. We negotiated. And then when we won, we thought we have to announce this because we have to stop the arrests of journalists and also overall illegal events, illegal arrests as we move into the next convention. We thought, what's the best place? Where could we reach the most police and protesters to let them know? So we came back to New York with our lawyers and we held a news conference at Occupy Wall Street. It was right in the middle at the height of Occupy in Zuccotti Park. We were surrounded by police and protesters. And we simply said, because part of the lawsuit settlement was that the St. Paul, Minneapolis police, the Secret Service would be trained in how to deal with journalists. By the way, the Secret Service tried to be severed from the lawsuit, saying at first they had nothing to do with this, but there was a problem because the police were then testifying that it was the Secret Service that ripped our credentials off. So we wouldn't agree to their separation from the suit. And it's just absolutely critical that journalists be allowed to function. There's a reason why our profession is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power.
As you write in your book, journalism is not a crime, right? And David, just real briefly, what's it like for you when you hear, uh-oh, my sister's busted again?
Well, the first phone call we got regarding, and also this relates to sort of the beginnings of democracy now. So, you know, really a turning point in Amy's work as a journalist and was in 1991 going to East Timor to chronicle a genocide that was going on essentially behind a curtain. The world knew nothing about it. Perhaps if you read Noam Chomsky, you'd heard of this place, this godforsaken place, East Timor, where one-third of the population had been killed by the occupying Indonesian government. And Amy survived a massacre there. And that's really... She was in the middle of it. She and Alan Nairn, another journalist who was... they had traveled there together. Alan was writing for The New Yorker. Amy was covering it for Pacifica Radio. And so in 1996, when she came home to tell the family, well, she has this new project. Anyway, it was harrowing, obviously, and they had to escape, and escaped, got to Guam and told the world. And
just as David tells that story, to understand its significance today is that, sadly, it was the U.S. government in 1975 that President Ford and Henry Kissinger, who went to Jakarta, met with the long-reigning dictator, gave the go-ahead for the Indonesian military to invade Timor. They invaded by land, by air, and by sea, and they commenced this genocide of 25 years. And Alan Nairn and I went to East Timor in 1990, then again in 91, and it was there on November 12, 1991, after 17 years of the slaughter, where, as David said, a third of the population was killed. The Timorese held another protest, and they marched from the Catholic Church. They were overwhelmingly Catholic because they've been colonized by Portugal for so many years, from the Catholic Church to the cemetery where so many young Timorese had been killed and older Timorese as well. And we followed them in this procession. And when we got to the cemetery, we asked people, why are you risking your life? This is a land where there's no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly, no freedom of the press. And yet you're putting up your hands in the V sign and shouting, Viva East Timor, Viva Independence. Why? And they would say, for my mother or my father. They would say, for my whole village. It was wiped out. And then we saw from the direction the procession had come, hundreds of Indonesian military soldiers holding their US M16s at the ready position. People were terrified. They couldn't get away. There were walls on either side of the road. There were cemeteries on both sides of the road. The soldiers marched up 10 to 12 abreast. Alan and I decided to walk to the front of the crowd because although we knew they had committed many massacres in the past, they'd never done it in front of Western journalists. We pulled out our equipment, put our headphones on, held our microphone up like a flag. Alan put the camera above his head. The soldiers marched up, US M16s at the ready position. They swept past us as they turned the corner. Thousands of people were behind us. A little boy right behind us had his hands up in the V sign. And without any warning, without any hesitation, without any provocation, the Indonesian military opened fire on the crowd, gunning people down from right to left. The little boy behind us exploded from the gunfire. a group of soldiers surrounded Alan and I. They took my microphone. Alan had gotten a photograph of them opening fire on the crowd. They were waving it in my face as if to say, this is what we don't want. And they beat me to the ground. Alan got that photograph, then threw himself on top of me to protect me from further injury. And they took their US M16s like baseball bats and they slammed them against his skull until they fractured it. We were laying in the road. Alan was covered in blood. They lined up in firing squad fashion and put the guns to our heads. They were shouting two things at us, politique and Australia. Politique, they were saying we were political to witness this. But that's our job as journalists, to go to where the silence is. They were shouting Australia. They wanted to know if we were from Australia. East Timor is a tiny island 300 miles above Australia. And in the lead up to the invasion in 1975, there were five Australian-based journalists covering the invasion. They lined them up against a house, and they executed them all. The final journalist who was reporting for the World, Roger East, was in a radio station in Dili, the capital of East Timor. And as he shouted, "I'm from Australia," they shot him into the harbor. The Australian government hardly did anything about the killing of their journalists. We believe years later it was because the Indonesian government and the Australian government signed the Timor Gap Treaty, dividing East Timor's oil between Australia and Indonesia. Oil is the source of so much pain in the world. So as we lay on the ground, Alan covered in blood, their guns to our heads, we knew the significance of them asking if we were from Australia. We shouted back, "No, no, we're from America, America." They'd stripped us now of everything. The only thing I had left was my passport. I pulled it out of my skirt. I threw it at them. Again, we were laying on the ground. They would kick me in the stomach. When I get my breath back, I'd say, "America, America." Finally, the soldiers took their guns from our heads. We believe because we were from the same country their weapons were from. They would have to pay a price for killing us that they had never had to pay for killing the Timorese. And they moved on, and they continued to kill people. A Red Cross Jeep pulled up. We got into it. Other Timorese jumped on top of us, and we drove like that as a human mass to the hospital. We got to the hospital. The doctors and nurses started to cry when they saw us, not because we were in worse shape than the Timorese. I mean, there were so many brave young people, 16, 17, 18, who had dragged their friends, their brothers and the sisters there who had been shot to be operated on. But I think they cried because of what we represent to the people of Timor, not just Alan, Naren, and I, but all of us, Americans, Westerners, and not just to Timor, but to people around the world. I think we represent two things, the sword and the shield. The sword, all too often, the U.S. government uses weapons in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, or provides those weapons to human rights abusing regimes like the Indonesian military. And that day they saw the government doing that, but they also see the people in a different way. And that's the shield for people. And that day they saw that blood, that shield bloodied, and it just deepened their despair. We were able to get away from the hospital. We went to Bishop Carlos Jimenez Bello's house, who would later win the Nobel Peace Prize. Thousands were taking refuge there. He was able to help me clean up Alan, whose head under his full head of dark hair was like a bathing cap of blood. We knew we had failed in stopping the massacre. The Indonesian military killed more than 250 Timorese that day. The only way possibly we could stop the continuing slaughter is to get out of the country and put pressure from outside. We raced to the hospital. The city was closed down at this point. The troops were everywhere. We continued to hear shooting in different parts of Dili. We went to the airport, and we didn't know if the Indonesian military had already decided not to kill us or they didn't realize we were at the massacre site. But somehow we were able to get on the last plane that day. And as we got onto the plane and the door closed, the flight attendants handed me a silver bowl of water, and they said, "Clean him." Alan was dripping with blood. We made our way from East Timor to West Timor, which is a part of Indonesia, to Bali, which is considered a paradise on earth, but is heavily surveilled by the Indonesian military in a way that most tourists would not understand. And we were able to make a call to the West. Alan phoned Western reporters, talked about the massacre that had been taking place, and I had wrapped his bloody shirt under a towel around my waist because I knew that the Indonesian military would probably deny that they had committed any massacre. We made our way back to the United States. They operated on Alan in Washington. His skull was fractured. When we got out, we held a news conference at the National Press Club. Not only did we say that a massacre had taken place, but that U.S. weapons were used. From the beginning, the United States had armed, financed, and trained the Indonesian military. 9 years later, the people of East Timor got to vote for their freedom in 1999. In 2002, they finally celebrated their independence as one of the newest nations in the world. Alan and I were able to go to East Timor, May 20th, 2002, where we observed the celebration. It was an astounding night. The founding president of the Democratic Republic of East Timor, Xanana Gusmao, who'd been imprisoned by the Indonesian military for so many years, got up and spoke many different languages, putting us all to shame. And then unfurled the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. There was this fireworks display. You could see the light reflected in the tear-stained faces of the people of Timor. They had resisted and they had won at an unbelievably high price, at an unacceptably high price, a third of their population killed. But they had won. This nation of survivors had prevailed. And they thanked people all over the world, especially from Western, the most powerful countries, who had told their governments to stop providing weapons to human rights abusing regimes. And it really was a lesson to all of us that night. Whether we are journalists, artists, professors, lawyers, judges, whether we are business people, students, artists, employed or unemployed, we have a decision to make every day, every hour of every day, and that is whether to represent the sword or the shield. That's the story of Timor that is now an independent nation in the world.
So you've earlier said that... Awesome. You earlier said that democracy is a messy thing and that it is the job of democracy now to capture it all, to go where the silence is and to give voice. So does mainstream media go where the silence is? I mean, I read the New York Times. I watch the national news. Should we be trusting mainstream media?
Well, I'm going to give that one to David because I've taken a lot of time here in answering that question.
There's a great media analyst, Danny Schechter, the late, great Danny Schechter, who some people may know, who had a book titled The More You Watch, The Less You Know. And in this...
Danny Schechter, the news dissector.
Yes, for many decades, and it was often a guest on Democracy Now!. He passed away, sadly, just in the last 18 months. You know, in this age of 500 channels, we sort of see it coming to almost an absurd kind of climax here in this presidential campaign, where truly the more you watch, the less you know. You know, we saw this first, I think, in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003, where the media, President Bush and Vice President Cheney, understood the media better than the media understood itself. They knew that, as Noam Chomsky says, the media manufactures consent, and that essentially is a megaphone for those in power. And Bush and Cheney understood that they could use that megaphone and turn this vast high-tech media empire into a very efficient conveyor belt for lies. And those lies cost lives. Those lies led us into a war. And there was a, there was an artfulness to this. There's what we've called in previous books that we wrote, the propaganda two-step. And that's where you had, for example, the lead national security correspondent for the New York Times, Judith Miller. Cheney and Bush float a lie about a mushroom cloud. You know, the smoking gun could be a mushroom cloud. This is the line that, they float this in a back channel to Judith Miller. Judith Miller puts it on the front page of the New York Times. This is pure propaganda, you know, coming from the administration. And Dick Cheney appears on Meet the Press on Sunday to say, don't take it from me, take it from the New York Times. That's the propaganda two-step, and that's the most sophisticated, most well-endowed media on earth and how it functioned. So fast forward to 2016, a presidential campaign where we have the appearance of, you know, where we now have another master of the media age, Donald Trump, in fact, a creation of that age, stepping out of one role in reality TV into another reality TV role, where the airwaves are essentially given over to him. He learns very quickly that if he is outrageous, says inflammatory things, he can essentially monopolize the networks. And we have, in fact, don't take it from us, take it from the president of CBS News, Les Moonves, who said just in the last few weeks, and I'm forgetting the direct quote, but it was to the effect of Trump
has been very good for us.
Trump has been very good for us. And we all know what the price of that is. We now have somebody elevated to a level, the top levels of American politics, while others, Bernie Sanders, the study that was done, Amy, that you've quoted, the Tyndale Report, explain that.
Well, and I want to get the quote exactly right that Les Moonves, the head of CBS, said. It may not be good for America, he said, about Donald Trump, but it's damn good for CBS. Yes, the Tyndall Report, really significant in 2015, compared the amount of coverage given to Donald Trump versus Bernie Sanders, 23 times the coverage Donald Trump got over Bernie Sanders. They looked at the hours spent that, you know, Donald Trump has mainly piped into everyone's homes. He doesn't have to go anywhere, where the other candidates do have to trek from state to state. Just look at what they called Super Tuesday 3 a couple weeks ago. Five state primaries. There was Missouri, Hillary Clinton's home state, Illinois, Marco Rubio's state of Florida, Ohio, and North Carolina. So let's look at that night and how the media covered that night. Marco Rubio pulled out. Of course, they played his speech. He had lost Florida. John Kasich won for the first time, and they played his speech. They played Ted Cruz's speech that night. Hillary Clinton gave a speech. She had just won three of the states. But the last two, Illinois and Missouri, were too close to call. She and Bernie Sanders were neck and neck. So this is really a tight race. The networks then say, and I'm not talking about one network, all three. There's this kind of shared consensus. And I'm talking about Fox, CNN, and MSNBC. They all played all of these speeches. Then they all say they are waiting for Donald Trump to hold a news conference. And they're showing the empty podium of Donald Trump that he set up in one of his mansions in Florida. And you just see it on the screen. And they're waiting, and they're waiting. They say it's going to be a news conference. Remember the big news conference he had for an hour. They didn't interrupt it at all. He was selling Trump water, Trump steaks, Trump magazines. And in fact, at that time, a few weeks before, Hillary Clinton had given a speech. They'd recorded it, not said that she'd given the speech, but then played it afterwards. They gave him his full hour. This time, they waited. They were covering the election. They filled it with the pundits. And finally, they played what Donald Trump had to say. what had happened to Bernie Sanders. It was the end of their coverage that night. Had he gone to sleep? Had he gone on vacation? They didn't even talk about where he was. In fact, Bernie Sanders was giving a speech to thousands of people in Phoenix. Why would he be iced out? Why wouldn't they even mention where he was? I don't care if you're for Trump, if you're for Cruz, if you're for Clinton. What is fair here? Why didn't we hear what Bernie Sanders had to say that night, especially when they were waiting with bated breath whether Hillary Clinton would win or Bernie Sanders would win? So the next morning on Democracy Now, we played an excerpt of Bernie Sanders' speech. Who would have thunk that it was a revolutionary act to play the speech of a major party candidate on primary night? They'd played everyone else's, but that's what it's become. And that's really unacceptable.
You write in the book, we can't know when or if our efforts will succeed, when that magic moment will take place, when movements take root, force change, and make history. Movements matter. And you write that movements give you hope. So, and I'm thinking right now the most recent movements, Black Lives Matter. Why do movements matter? Why should they give us hope?
Movements make history. Movements will determine the future. Actually, it's not about one individual, even if they occupy the most powerful position on earth, right? The presidency of the United States. It's the movements through history that have made the difference. Think about it. The abolition movement, the women's suffrage movement, the environmental movement, the gay and lesbian movement, the immigrants' rights movement. You think about this is the best of America. The Black Lives Movement, the Black Lives Matter movement comes out of a history. It comes out of abolition. It comes out of the civil rights movement. And these young people around the country are changing the language and agenda of these leading politicians. You know, no network is just handing them a microphone. So they have to grab it at their presidential speeches or their election speeches. And they are challenging the politicians on their records. You know, you had one young woman who opened a banner at a private fundraiser Hillary Clinton had in South Carolina. And it said, I am not a super predator. And it was referring to Hillary Clinton saying in 1996 in support of President Bill Clinton's 1994 crime bill, talking about certain Black and Latino youth, talking about them as super predators. And they are making a point. They just interrupted Bill Clinton as well in a speech he just gave. And in the end, while he wasn't willing to fully apologize, he did say maybe he shouldn't have been so intemperate. And they have admitted that the crime bill, and I really encourage people to read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, a Bible of all movements today. But you can trace a direct line from the 1994 crime bill of Bill Clinton to the over-incarceration, the mass incarceration, particularly of Black and Latino and poor people today. And that's what the Black Lives Matter movement is bringing to the fore and forcing the media to deal with.
David, do you want to add anything?
Movements, you know, there's a view of history, you know, the great man view, that a great man, and it always does seem to be a man, steps forward and people follow him, this sort of messianic view of history. But on Democracy Now!, in the books we write, it's rarely an individual that it's individuals in concert with movements that actually affect change. And so, you know, we talk about, we revisit some in past books, some of the historic figures like Rosa Parks, often described as this, you know, merely a seamstress, a tired old seamstress who refused to give up her seat. Rosa Parks came steeped in movement training and movement history, was strategically selected for the role that she played, came out of the Highlander School in Tennessee, which is, you know, the mother church of grassroots activism and training. So Rosa Parks didn't just happen to do anything. It was part of a very well thought out plan where she was a very well trained member of a movement to then catalyze the Montgomery boycott. Nothing happens by accident. And really, the big changes are because of thoughtful movements working in concert.
Right. And your book is filled with inspiring stories about ordinary people who did extraordinary things. And one of the people you talk about in the book is Bree Newsom. And would you tell us just briefly a little bit about her?
You know, I think if most people were asked today, who brought down the Confederate flag off the State House grounds in South Carolina, people would say Governor Nikki Haley, that she spearheaded this movement. But let's really look at what happened. You have the horrific massacre of the 9 parishioners at Mother Emanuel Church who were simply engaging in Bible study in June of 2015, led by their beloved Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who is also a state senator. Gunned down by a young man, a white supremacist, a Confederate supporter named Dylan Storm Roof, who I'm sure to his own horror blew the roof off the Confederacy by gunning down these innocent, defenseless people. Their families and the survivors of this killing put South Carolina to shame when the young man, Dylan Roof, was being arraigned. They were told they could say something, and they forgave him. This was within a few days of the massacre, they're losing the most precious people in their lives. And they forgive this man. They show him compassion, which leads to the state legislature having to weigh how is it possible that they continue to fly the Confederate flag, the symbol of the Confederacy, on the State House grounds and have done this for over half a century. So they're beginning to have these debates. Should we take it down? We went down to Charleston. We covered the mass funeral for Reverend Clemente Pinckney. President Obama came. He sang Amazing Grace. Thousands of people were there. The next day were the funerals of some of the worshipers who were killed. We then heard that something was happening 2 hours away in Columbia. It was 5:30 in the morning on June 27, 2015, 10 days after the massacre at the Emanuel Church. The South Carolina State House glowed in the morning light. Bree Newsom, a 30-year-old African-American woman from Charlotte, North Carolina, walked toward the main entrance of the building. She was accompanied by Jimmy Tyson, a young white man from North Carolina. The two activists proceeded to the 30-foot-high flagpole that stood directly behind a Confederate monument, which pays tribute to those who, quote, have glorified a fallen cause, slavery. They walk behind the monument. The Confederate battle flag flapped lazily at the top. Tyson helped Newsom over a fence that surrounded the flagpole. She donned a climbing gear and began ascending the pole swiftly. Tyson watched her from below, ready to break her fall if she slipped. Guards noticed and began shouting for her to come down. Reaching the top of the flagpole, she grabbed the Confederate flag and unhooked it. And then she declared from the top of the flagpole, "You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God." She clutched the symbol of the Confederacy and said, "This flag comes down today." She lowered herself slowly along with the flag. As soon as she reached the ground, Newsom and Tyson were arrested. Video of the protests went viral and was seen around the world. Her bail fund quickly raised more than $125,000. Ava DuVernay, director of the Oscar-nominated film Selma, was among the many to hail her, tweeting, "I hope I get the call to direct the motion picture about a black superhero I admire. Her name is Bree Newsom." But within about an hour, two state house workers raised a new Confederate flag on the Capitol grounds. They raised a new Confederate flag on the Capitol grounds. This is after the massacre of the nine parishioners. This is after Reverend Clemente Pinckney lay in state at the Capitol grounds, and thousands of people had to stream by that Confederate flag to honor him. So the flag was raised again, and Bree and Jimmy were taken to face a bond hearing at a nearby jail. As part of the compromise struck by the South Carolina legislature in 2000 to keep the Confederate flag flying next to the state house instead of on top of the state house, lawmakers escalated the penalty for tampering with the flag. So Newsom and Tyson were charged with defacing state property, facing a penalty of up to 3 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. I had come to South Carolina to cover the aftermath of the massacre. We immediately went to Columbia to the lobby of the jail where Newsom and Tyson, we thought, would soon be released, and interviewed people there who had gathered to support them. And so many young people, like Tamika Lewis, who said, to see that flag actually come down and all the things that it represents being taken down by a strong black woman was one of the greatest symbolic images that one person could ever witness. Another young woman who didn't know Bree, but was so moved when she heard this had happened that day. She lived in Columbia, this woman named Carol Parker. She came to the jail to show her support and said she's done what our governor hasn't had the courage to do, what our General Assembly hasn't had the courage to do. She went up there and did what had to be done when it needed to be done. Yes, the state legislature did eventually vote to take down the Confederate flag, but it was Bree Newsom who scaled that flag and took that flag down for everyone.
Bree.
You know, another look at movements that brings us right up to today, Occupy Wall Street. This incredible global uprising happens in late 2011, and this is certainly the short version of it. Encampments appear all around the country, all around the world. They get busted up violently by police from New York to Oakland, and the conventional wisdom in the corporate media is it just went away, it failed, it got stamped out, or did it? So let's watch what happens to this movement, this uprising around inequality. The encampment begins in September 2011. By December, it's broken up in Zuccotti Park is cleared, although there are various efforts to take it back. In January, now we're into a presidential year, Mitt Romney utters the famous 47% quote, that 47% of people are just moochers, parasites on the government. Inequality becomes an issue in the 2012 election that essentially takes down the Republican frontrunner. He can never shake his 47% now that we have the lexicon of the 99% and the 1%. That's 2012. November 2012, fast food workers in New York City and then around the country. First, it begins at Walmart with a Black Friday strike at Walmarts around the country. Some of the most vulnerable workers, you know, in the workforce. And then it spreads to several hundred fast food workers in New York walk off the job, leave the Taco Bells and McDonald's, demanding something completely outrageous, a $15 minimum wage. Never going to happen. So we're up to 2012. So we keep moving forward. In Seattle, suddenly, 2013 it is, or 2014, Kashama Savant, a city councilor there, campaigns for the city council on a platform of bringing a $15 minimum wage to a major American city. It passes. It becomes law in Seattle and then L.A. So now we move to last spring. And we chronicle this in the book, but let's move to New York. Do we really think that Governors Jerry Brown and Andrew Cuomo just decided to double the federal minimum wage? The federal minimum wage is $7.25, which earns you a annual salary of $14,000 a year, which is below the federal poverty line. So we write, in July 2015, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who has opposed numerous progressive initiatives, responded to the relentless protests by low-wage workers and by progressive New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio by announcing that fast food workers throughout New York State should be paid $15 an hour, a 70% increase over the state minimum wage. But wait, this represented an about-face for the man dubbed Governor 1% by activists. In March 2015, that's three, 4 months before he enacts it. In March 2015, Cuomo had dismissed a plan by the New York State Assembly Democrats to raise the state minimum wage to $15 by 2018. Cuomo said, quote, God bless him, shoot for the stars, Cuomo said sarcastically during a speech in Rochester, suggesting that their goal was unrealistic. He later told reporters the figure was, quote, too high. On May 6th, 2015, keep track of the timing here, shoot for the stars in March. In May, he writes an op-ed in the New York Times headlined, Fast Food Workers Deserve a Raise. He wrote, quote, this is a quote from Governor Andrew Cuomo, nowhere is the income gap more extreme and obnoxious than in the fast food industry. Fast food CEOs are among the highest paid corporate executives. The average fast food CEO made $23.8 million in 2013, more than quadruple the average from 2000. Meanwhile, entry-level food service workers in New York State earn, on average, about $17,000 a year, which at a 40-hour week amounts to $8.50 an hour. Nationally, wages for fast food workers have increased 0.3% since 2000. New York State ranks first in public assistance spending for fast food workers, $6,800 a year. That's a $700 million annual cost to taxpayers. And we write, you would think Cuomo's op-ed was written by grassroots activists. In a way, it was. That's the power of movements.
So we're going to take some questions now from the audience, from you all. I have over two dozen questions. We're not going to get through not even a few of them. So let's just, and again, if you can keep your answers more concise, we'll get through more of them. Here we go. Speaking of the mess of democracy, what actions can be taken to overturn Citizens United and get public funding only for national presidential elections?
You know, it's interesting that that question is asked as hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of people have just been arrested in Washington, D.C., demanding money out of politics. We don't even know who's pouring this money in because of Citizens United protecting the dark money. And I really recommend another book. The great New Yorker magazine staff writer Jane Mayer wrote the book Dark Money about the Koch family empire, the fact that in this election year, I think the Republicans are expected to pour about $1 billion into the election, same with the Democrats. And then so are the Koch brothers and their allies. You know, this isn't a party. This is a group of billionaires and beyond who are working from the state level on up to change the face of America. And there are people all over this country that, like those who marched these past weeks from Philadelphia to Washington and then got arrested this week.
Freedom marchers.
Freedom marchers. The woman in New Hampshire who fought so hard, Granny D, to change politics as it's practiced today. We treasure the idea of one person, one vote. Not one corporation, one vote, but one person, one vote. And I think there is no way politics will remain the way they are today. You look at the movement, for example, around Bernie Sanders, so unlikely that he would have the support he does today. If you look at the lack of attention he gets in the media until recently, he has broken every record, right? In March alone, he raised $44 million. Hillary Clinton raised less than $30 million. And how did he do it? This isn't about whether you support him or you don't support him, but he gets an average of $27 per contribution. It is truly astounding what has happened. Over 6 million people have contributed, and they keep contributing because they're giving $3 and $6 and $9. There is something afoot in the land, and it's across the political spectrum. People feel like they are not having the kind of say that they deserve in a democracy, and they're going to fight to get that say.
During the Vietnam War, there were riots in large measure composed of college students vulnerable to the draft. Now, without a draft, we have the Iraq War, Afghanistan, for example. It goes on with little notice here. Should we bring back the draft? Would that help bring peace?
I mean, this is a very interesting debate because on the one hand, there's no question that when you have a cross-section of society that's forced to fight these wars, when Congress members and their own children are actually fighting, they would be a lot less likely to send their children to their doom. And that's the argument for a draft. But there are others who feel that to institutionalize the demand for human beings as fodder in these senseless wars, that that's not the right approach. So it's something that we need a media to provide a forum for people to speak for themselves, to have these critical debates, and ultimately to have real, honest, open debates about ending war. How often you get in the networks the debate between do we bomb from the air or put boots on the ground? What about not attacking at all?
So what obstacles do you both face from the power elite in terms of your effort to disseminate information and educate the masses with independent media?
We just continue to ask the questions, to demand answers. I'm going to go back to a very interesting experience I had on Election Day in 2000. This was the day that President Clinton called into Democracy Now! Well, this is what happened. It was about few minutes before the show broadcast in the morning in New York, and the producers had already gone into the studio. It was when we were just a radio show. Now we're broadcasting on 1,400 public television and radio stations. At the time, we were just on radio. And he called in, we got a call. The producers were in the control room in the studio ready to go. The music was just getting queued up. And I thought, who calls right before the show? It must be an emergency. I'll pick it up. And they said, White House Communications. I thought they said White Horse Communications. Because, you know, I'm in New York. White Horse is a famous tavern where Dylan Thomas drank himself to death. And I thought that, I don't understand who's calling. And they said, the president. I said, the president of a tavern at 9 o'clock in the morning? And they said, the president of the United States of America. I said, oh, White House Communications. So I said, oh, he's calling Democracy Now! And they said, yes, he wants to call in, be on the air to talk about getting out the vote. You know, this is 2000. This is Hillary Clinton is running for senator in New York and Al Gore is running for president. So I said, okay, we're going on the air. I gave them the internal number. I ran into the studio. The producers were frantic. What the heck were you doing? They asked. I said, I don't know. They say that President Clinton's going to call in. I mean, this may all be a hoax, but you definitely should answer the phone if he does. Think about questions. I don't know if this is going to happen. The show went on. He didn't call. We went off the air at the end. We are going off to have coffee because it's going to be a long day. It's Election Day 2000. We figure, you know, the end of the night, we're going to know who the new president will be. Of course, who knew it was going to take 5 weeks and it wouldn't be an election. It would be a selection by the Supreme Court. But anyway, We're just walking out the door, and Gonzalo Alberto, the Alternativa Latina music producer, was on the air with all the salsa music, and we hear this this panicked scream, a shriek from the control room. Amy, get in here. The president of the United States is on the phone. So me and the producers run in. Wait, the producers and I run in. And Gonzalo is there. He's paralyzed over the board. All the music faders are up. All the microphones are down. And you hear it drowning in the salsa music, President Clinton saying, "Is anyone there? Is anyone there?" And so I couldn't even tell which fader was for which piece of equipment. I threw down all the music faders, and I threw up all the microphones to be hot in the room, like seven mics, because I didn't know which was mine or Gonzalo's. And this was it. I said, "President Clinton, many people are wondering if they should go out to vote because they feel that the Democratic and Republican parties are bought by corporations." And President Clinton answered, and he gave an extended answer to that. And he was still on the phone. So I asked him, I said, "I heard that you were weighing clemency for the Native American leader, Leonard Peltier, whether to release him or grant him clemency or commute his sentence in jail." And he responded to that. We then asked him about the napalming of the Puerto Rican island of Vieques that the U.S. Navy was doing, and asked him about the assistant U.N. secretary generals, one after another, who had quit, calling the U.S. sanctions against Iraq genocidal. He answered all of these questions. I then asked him, you know, Ralph Nader was running for president then. He was quite successful. And I asked if his success could be attributed to President Clinton taking the Democratic Party to the right. Then he got annoyed. And he said, "I find you hostile, combative, and at times disrespectful." So I said, "Well, then I just have a few more questions." And I ended by asking him, you know, I said, "Vice President Gore said if he becomes president, his first act in office would be to outlaw racial profiling." And I said, "You guys have been in office for 8 years. Why haven't you done it until now?" Anyway, he said he had to get off. It had been about half an hour. And that was the end of the conversation, live music show on WBAI in New York. And the next day, we ran it on Democracy Now! It got its second airing right after the show. I went into the office, and the phone is ringing. I pick it up. This is still when we have, you know, wired phones. And they say it's White House, and I know it's not White Horse Communications. They say it's the White House, and they say I will be banned from coming to the White House. I said, "I will be banned? He called me. I didn't call him." And they said, "You violated all the rules." I said, "What rules?" They said, "We said that the president wanted to talk about getting out the vote. You asked question 1, 4, and 7, something like that, related to that, but nothing else did." I said, "Really? I asked that many questions related to what he wanted to talk about?" I was rather surprised and disappointed in myself. But I said, "It sounds like you have a transcript of this conversation. Could you send it to us? Because we'd like to post it." And I said, and then they said, "We told you he had 2 or 3 minutes. You kept him on the phone for half an hour." I said, "The man is the leader of the free world. He's the most powerful person on earth. He can hang up if he wants to." I asked how many reporters he'd called, and he said he had called about 40 reporters in New York, you know, radio stations. And I said, "And they all abided by the rules, asked only that question about getting out the vote." And they said, "That's right." I said, "Well, that's a very sad comment on American journalism." Anyway, I had been speaking right before to a reporter for New York Newsday at the time, the paper in New York, and I had just put his phone down while I spoke to the White House. And at the end of that conversation, this had gotten a lot of press attention, our conversation with the president on the air. At the end of the conversation, I picked the phone back up for the reporter. I said, "I'm so sorry, that was White House." He said, "I heard your side of the conversation. I've got everything I need. Thank you very much."
Wow. Well,
awesome.
Well, unfortunately, and I really mean unfortunately, we have come to the point in our program where we have to close. And, you know, normally we ask, you know, one final question, but I don't want to do that this time. What I would like to do is ask both of you to read together, because I'd love to hear your voices together, a passage in your book, and in the book, the copy I have, it's on page 10. You see the clip there. And I think that passage beautifully describes your amazing work as independent journalists. And it starts with the word we need. Mm-hmm. And would that be okay if we can end with that? And before you read it, I want to let everyone know that Amy and David will be signing copies of their books here in the front of the room here. So we'll close with that, if you wouldn't mind.
And Judge Cordell, I just want to say what an honor it is to be interviewed by you, who have, you know, broken through every ceiling there is. It's just very moving for David and I to be having this conversation with you. We have great respect for you and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, we can read it together. You can start the words because I think I know this by heart. Okay.
We need a media that covers power, not covers
for power.
We need a media that acts
is the fourth estate,
not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static
and make history.
That is the power of independent media.
That is a media that will save us.
Thank you.
Yes. Wow.
Look at this. That's right. Yes. Yes. Stand up. Take your time. Keep clapping. All right, sweetie, thank you. Thank you so much. So again, we thank Amy and David Goodman, authors of Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America. And we thank those of you joining us on the radio and on the web.
Can I add that our co-author is here as well, Dennis Moynihan, and he'll also be signing the book.
Thank you so much. And Amy Goodman, David Goodman, thank you for joining us, and thank you for courageously doing your part to bend the arc of the moral universe toward justice. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is now adjourned.